For the men, the sometimes 17-hour stretch between the two meals was difficult. Even Cherry, the consummate experienced explorer, complained in his diary one night, after a long ride without anything to eat until 10 p.m., that they were all nearly famished. More troubling than their own growing hunger was the visibly deteriorating condition of their mules and oxen. The open, sandy stretch of the Brazilian highlands was extremely inhospitable for the pack animals. "It was rarely that we saw here a tree more than 15 or 20 feet high," Father Zahm recalled, "and certain areas were as treeless as the desert lands of New Mexico or Arizona. During our first day in this arid land, we did not find a drop of water for a stretch of 20 miles. There was no way to carry heavy bags of grain, so the mules and oxen were simply set free at night to wander in an often fruitless search for grass and water. Then, as the rainy season downpours began in earnest, the dry dirt trail on which they were traveling turned to mud, forming a slick hazard for the animals. Worse trouble lay ahead. For the men in the mule train, the first warning signs appeared when they began to see the skeletons of oxen and mules that had starved to death or been eaten during previous expeditions, most likely Rondons. Although their startlingly white bones, bleached by the sun to a ghostly hue, indicated that they had died many months, if not years, earlier, that knowledge was of little comfort to Roosevelt and his men as they encountered unharnessed oxen from their own baggage train staggering slowly along the road. Having grown too weak from hunger and hard use to keep up with the rest of the train, the unfortunate beasts had simply been released and left to die. The men were stunned by the sight they encountered next. Strewn across their path, settling into the thick mud, were unopened supply crates, all clearly marked Roosevelt's South American Expedition. The pack animals, who were still making their weary way across the plateau ahead of the mule train, had begun bucking off their heavy loads. As the officers in the mule train rode slowly past the boxes on their tired mounts, they wondered what they were leaving behind, and how precious it might seem to them in the months to come. What became of this food we had so carefully selected in New York, and which we had looked after so solicitously for thousands of miles, it would be interesting to know, Zahm wrote. It was impossible for anyone to collect it and add it to our other stores which had been sent ahead, and impossible for our pack animals to carry it, for their burdens were already as great as they could bear. The men also began to show signs of strain. Three Brazilians, a doctor, a lieutenant, and a botanist, had already resigned their posts, having lost all faith in what they now believed was a fatally unorganized and mismanaged expedition. Worse than the malcontent officers, however, was a volatile camarada who had been assigned to Amilcar's baggage train in Tapirapoan. Julio de Lima, a full-blooded Portuguese from Bahia, had already given his captain good reason to worry. Just a few weeks into the overland journey, he viciously attacked another camarada with a knife, and was prevented from injuring or even killing him only because Amilcar and one of his lieutenants, Vieira de Mello, stepped in and wrenched the weapon from his hand. Amilcar punished Julio, the only time he was forced to punish one of his men during the overland journey. But he was left with a foreboding about the violent camarada that he could not shake. Drawn together by their ordeal, the men of the expedition quickly grew to know one another well. After riding together all day long, they shared tents at night and during pounding rainstorms, which were now all too frequent, and they ate every meal together. Each night, after erecting tents, organizing baggage, and peeling off their drenched clothes, the men would gather around two ox hides that had been spread over the damp ground and laid with rations of rice, beans, pork, and beef. The men, Rondon noted, squatted in the Yedo and Tokyo fashion, some with a certain amount of elegance and others in a very clumsy posture. But they honored our table with that joviality which can only be prepared by the exercise of long marches in the open, breathing the fresh and oxygenated air of the virgin forests and drinking from the running waters of the rivers. It was during these dinners and afterward, as they sat under the bright southern stars, that the Brazilians and Americans began to forge the mutual respect and friendship that often develops between men who camp together for long periods of time in rough conditions, even men who do not share a common language. They relied on expressions, gestures, and an international amalgam of tongues that, in Roosevelt's words, consisted of English, Portuguese, bad French, and broken German. Their conversation often centered on the river toward which they were riding, its length, its character, where it would take them, and when they would reach its end. But the river of doubt still seemed impossibly far away, and their past lives were ever present in vivid and often disturbing memories. It was not long before the men began to tell stories from their former expeditions into the wilderness, whether South American, North American, African, or Arctic. Although Roosevelt was widely considered the best raconteur, the competition from this group of well-traveled, adventurous, and courageous men was impressive. Rondon enthralled his audience with memories of long expeditions through uncharted land. Roosevelt and his son shared stories from their year-long hunting safari in Africa, during which they had earned the nicknames Bwana Makubwa, or Great Master, and Bwana Mardadi, Dandy Master. And Miller, Roosevelt recalled, told of the stone gods and altars and temples he had seen in the great Colombian forests, monuments of strange civilizations which flourished and died out ages ago, and of which all memory has vanished. Cherry, who had had perhaps a wider range of experiences than any man present, remained relatively silent until one night when the conversation turned to cavalry battles. Despite himself, the taciturn naturalist nodded somberly when someone mentioned the powerful psychological effect of a shining, razor-sharp lance. Their curiosity aroused by Cherry's obvious first-hand knowledge of the subject, the men would not leave him alone until he told his story. It was while he was fighting with the Venezuelan insurgents in an unsuccessful uprising against the tyranny of Castro, Roosevelt wrote of Cherry's involvement in the effort to topple Venezuelan tyrant Cipriano Castro. He was on foot with five Venezuelans, all cool men and good shots. In an open plain they were charged by 20 of Castro's lancers, who galloped out from behind cover 200 or 300 yards off. It was a war in which neither side gave quarter, and in which the wounded and the prisoners were butchered. Cherry knew that it meant death for him and his companions if the charge came home, and the sight of the horsemen running in at full speed with their long lances in rest and the blades glittering left an indelible impression on his mind. But he and his companion shot deliberately and accurately. 10 of the lancers were killed, the nearest falling within 50 yards, and the others rode off in headlong haste. A cool man with a rifle, if he has mastered his weapon, need fear no foe. Few tales of exploration or even warfare, however, could compete with Anthony Fiala's memories of spending 2 years trapped in the frozen north. The supply ship that was supposed to relieve the expedition never appeared, and if it had not been for seal blubber, an unlucky polar bear, and the frozen caches of food left behind by earlier expeditions, he and his men would have starved. As they listened to Fiala's stories of disaster and near death in the polar north, Roosevelt and the other officers could not have helped but reflect on the fact that the commander of that expedition was the quartermaster of theirs. Fiala was not leading them into the Amazon, but he had chosen and packed everything that they would rely on to keep themselves alive during the months to come. On January 25th, some good news arrived for Roosevelt and his men in the almost surreal form of 3 huge all-terrain trucks. The autovans, as Zahm called them, rattled into camp that night on their way to the Utiarity telegraph station, the expedition's next stop, and the point at which it would turn west and head directly toward the River of Doubt. The trucks, which belonged to the Rondon Commission, each carried 2 tons of freight and had been outfitted with wide slatted belts that wrapped around the wheels on each side like tank treads, forming what Miller referred to as an endless trail through the thick mud. This invention, which anticipated the use of the first military tank 2 years later during World War I, amazed and elated the explorers. It was a strange sight to see them racing across the uninhabited Chapadong at a speed of 30 miles an hour, Miller wrote. Surely this was exploring deluxe. No member of the expedition appreciated deluxe travel more than Father Zahm. The next morning, he secured two seats on one of the trucks for himself and the Swiss handyman Jakob Sig, whom he had long since appropriated as his personal assistant. Cherry and Miller also decided to ride in one of the trucks so that they would have a chance to do some collecting before the rest of the expedition caught up with them. Father Zahm, however, was unhappy with his ride in the auto van. According to Rondon, the priest was deeply offended that he had had to ride beside the driver, a black man, which he never forgave. While in Bahia, Father Zahm had been impressed with the successful mingling of the races. "Truth to tell," he wrote, "there is not a little to say in favor of the fusion of the European and African races in Brazil. For some of the most distinguished men the country has produced have had a strain of Negro blood in their veins." However, whatever his intellectual and theoretical opinions about racial integration, he clearly believed that the United States was not ready to take such a drastic step, and neither was he. In Brazil, Zahm wrote, "Whites, Indians, and Negroes associate together in a way which would be quite impossible with us, and which an old Virginian planter would condemn as an abomination unutterable." Father Zahm, on the other hand, had no problem voicing his complaints about the ignorant and careless Negro, who, as a favor to Rondon, had driven him to Utiariti. And he thereafter, Rondon wrote, referred to that truck ride as a measure of how much he had suffered during the expedition. It would have been difficult for Father Zahm to find a better or faster way to alienate Rondon than to make a racist comment about one of his men. Not only was Rondon proud of his soldiers, but he was a humanist and a champion of minority rights. He had also been a victim of racism himself, and would continue to be for most of his life, in spite of all that he had achieved. "The colonel possesses the temperament of the savage," a Brazilian journalist would write 4 years later. "In the centers of civilization he feels out of place. He is a lost cause, because he has a high percentage of Indian blood mixed with the worst habits the centers of civilization have to offer." Father Zahm was also openly scornful of Rondon's philosophical beliefs and the deferential treatment he accorded Brazil's indigenous peoples. In the introduction to his book, Evolution and Dogma, Zahm had made it clear that he considered positivism to be dangerous and subversive. "Our great, or more truthfully, our greatest enemy in the intellectual world today," he wrote, "is naturalism, variously known as agnosticism, positivism, empiricism, which, as the British statesman Mr. Arthur J. Balfour well observes, is in reality the only system which ultimately profits by any defeats which theology may sustain, or which may be counted on to flood the spaces from which the tide of religion has receded." The priest made a point of baptizing both Brazilian settlers and Indians at several stops along the way on both their river journey up the Paraguay and Sepotuba rivers and their mule ride through the highlands. While he bristled at the implication that Zahm was saving savage souls, Rondon never tried to stop him. "Although the Indian service would not catechize, respecting the spiritual freedom and the way of life of the Indians under its protection," he wrote, "it would not prevent others from trying to convert them to their beliefs, provided that they didn't force them." Compounding the growing frictions caused by harsh terrain, meager rations, and personality clashes was the ever-present risk of accident and illness. In early January, when the men had reached San Luis de Cáceres, a small town on the Paraguay River, Rondon had learned that four of the soldiers that he had posted there were now dead. Three had drowned while trying to ascend the Ji Paraná, a 500-mile-long river in western Mato Grosso, and another man, Captain Cardoso, had succumbed to beriberi, a disease brought on by a thiamine deficiency, along the same route that Roosevelt's expedition was traveling. A few weeks later, in Tapirapoan, illness had cost Roosevelt the assistance of his right-hand man, Frank Harper. As Roosevelt's personal representative during the planning and equipping of the expedition, Harper had worked to protect the ex-president's interests and was the only member of the expedition, other than Zahm and Fiala, with knowledge about the specific content of the crates and boxes that the baggage train was now laboring to deliver to the River of Doubt. Harper had contracted malaria early in the journey and had been miserable ever since. He was not the only man on the expedition to suffer from the mosquito-borne infection, but he had gotten a vivid preview of the miseries that awaited him on the River of Doubt, and he wanted out. On January 18th, 3 days before the other men left on their overland journey, Harper announced that he had had enough and had decided to return home. Beyond the additional logistical burdens it imposed on Roosevelt, Harper's departure pointed up the acute vulnerability, in medical terms, that the expedition could expect to face for the duration of the journey. For despite the gravity of his illness, Harper had nevertheless had the option of returning with relative speed and safety to well-equipped medical facilities and, ultimately, the comfort of his own home. Once embarked upon their overland journey, however, Roosevelt and his men no longer had that safety net. And even otherwise minor illnesses acquired in the wilderness or on the river itself could have fatal consequences. The expedition did have a doctor, a tough, serious, and highly competent man named José Cajazeira, whom Rondon had hired in Corumbá. But as Roosevelt knew, Dr. Cajazeira was only a thin line of defense against the dangers of the Amazon. A good doctor is an absolute necessity on an exploring expedition in such a country as that we were in, under penalty of a frightful mortality among the members, Roosevelt wrote. The necessary risks and hazards are so great, the chances of disaster so large, that there is no warrant for increasing them by the failure to take all feasible precautions. Unbeknownst to anyone in the expedition but Kermit and Roosevelt himself, having a doctor on hand for the former president was more than an ordinary precaution. More than a decade earlier, while he was campaigning in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Roosevelt's carriage had been struck by a runaway trolley. One of his Secret Service agents had been killed instantly, and he had been thrown 30 feet. The accident had left Roosevelt with loosened teeth, a swollen and bruised cheek, a black eye, and a severe injury to his left leg. The infection that followed had nearly led to blood poisoning, a disease that, in a time before antibiotics, often proved deadly. Even 6 years after the accident, when Roosevelt was in his second term in the White House, he wrote Kermit that he had never gotten over the effects of the trolley car accident, when, as you will remember, they had to cut down to the shin bone. The shock permanently damaged the bone, and if anything happens, there is always a chance of trouble which would be serious. Kermit, realizing that he had come close to losing his father that day, had been traumatized by the accident. Afterward, he had declared that from then on he must be on hand to protect his father. In fact, that accident, and the threat that it would forever after pose to Roosevelt's life, was one of the principal reasons Kermit had felt compelled to join this expedition into the Amazon. You see, he has never quite recovered from the accident he had when the wagon he was driving in got run over by a trolley, he had explained to Bell. One of his legs is still pretty bad and needs a lot of care. Right now, however, it was Kermit rather than his father who needed a lot of care. To Roosevelt's deep dismay, even before Harper prepared to return home, Kermit also fell ill with malaria. As his father looked on, utterly miserable with worry, the younger Roosevelt became so ill with fever and chills that he could not manage to rise from his hammock. Arguing that he had long since become accustomed to the rigors of the tropics, Kermit refused to yield to his illness or to consider returning in Harper's footsteps. But the specter of his son's suffering made a powerful impression on the elder Roosevelt, who was left to ponder, amid the rapidly mounting difficulties the expedition was facing, how heavy a toll he might ultimately be forced to pay for his decision to descend the River of Doubt. In late January, upon reaching Utiarity, the remote telegraph station that constituted one of the last tentative outposts of official exploration into Brazil's dark interior, Roosevelt learned that his fears about the risk of illness had already been realized. Thousands of miles away, in New York City, the deadly diseases of the tropics had claimed their first victim from his expedition. his young cousin, Margaret Roosevelt. Waiting for Roosevelt at the lonely telegraph office was a short, devastating message informing him that Margaret had died 3 weeks before from typhoid fever contracted on her journey to South America. It was the same infectious disease that had killed his mother 30 years earlier. The young woman had first begun to show signs of illness in early December, a few days after she and her aunt left Panama. Edith was baffled. Margaret drank only bottled water and ate no salad, she had written despondently in her diary after Margaret's death. Can't imagine how she got the typhoid. Edith, shaken by the sudden loss of her cousin and young companion, had attended the funeral 2 days later. Poor Henry Hunt there, she had written that night. She felt pity for the man who had fallen in love with Margaret on the Van Dyke and had lost her before he had even had a chance to win her. A hemisphere away from New York, in the remote wilderness of Brazil, the delayed news of Margaret's death had an unusually powerful and unsettling impact, casting a pall over the entire expedition that had started in her youthful, vibrant company nearly 4 months before. Having looked forward to their arrival in Utiarity as one of their last contacts with civilization and a reason for festivities, Roosevelt's men found even that small pleasure stolen from them, and quickly forgot any thought of celebration. The men of the Roosevelt-Rondon scientific expedition somberly returned their thoughts to the trip before them, and to very real concerns about their own mortality in the months to come. Chapter 8. Hard Choices. Heavy sheets of rain swept over Utiarity the day after Roosevelt reached it, drenching the muddy little village and its population, which was more than doubled by the arrival of the mule team. Even in such a squall, however, the town offered a welcome respite for Roosevelt and his men. Little more than a clearing in the rough, scrubby forest that surrounded it, Utiarity was divided into two parts. One section was composed of the buildings of the Rondon Commission, and the other, where the Parecis Indians lived, was a set of 12 rectangular huts with steeply pitched palm-thatch roofs, held up by roughly hewn wooden poles. In a sense, the village was a triumph of man over nature, having been carved out of the wilderness just a few years earlier by a handful of telegraph-line soldiers. But it was a temporary victory at best. Utiarity's grounds were nothing but forlorn-looking stretches of stone-pocked dirt encircled by a seemingly endless green expanse of trees and vines. Wherever the citizens of Utiarity looked, there was wild nature, waiting to reclaim what was rightfully her own. The Parecis Indians, who had made their peace with Rondon and his men some years earlier, had been convinced to abandon their nearby forest villages to work at and help protect the telegraph station. Unlike the men of the expedition, the Parecis were accustomed to the sweltering heat and driving rain of their native climate, and did not see why the deluge should inhibit their celebrations in honor of the expedition's presence. Whenever the downpour let up, the Parecis would quickly gather in the square to play a rousing ball game that fascinated their visitors. The ball, which the Parecis made themselves, was a light, hollow sphere of rubber about 8 inches in diameter. The players, of whom there were 8 or 10 on each team, would line up facing one another with the ball on the ground between them. Then suddenly, to the joy of the small crowd, one player would run into the middle, dive head first at the ground, and butt the ball with his head as hard as he could. A player from the other team would then butt the ball back, this time sending it high enough into the air that one of his opponents could catch it on his head. Roosevelt wrote, "With such a swing of his brawny neck, and such precision and address, that the ball bounds back through the air as a football soars after a drop kick." The game continued until one player was able to connect with the ball so successfully, never using any part of his anatomy but his head, that it flew high over the heads of his opponents, for an obvious and thrilling goal that sent the fans of the winning team into shrill, elated cries of victory. The Americans were impressed by the skill and dexterity of the players, but taken aback by the wild abandon with which they threw themselves head first toward the hard, rock-studded ground. "Why they do not grind off their noses, I cannot imagine," Roosevelt marveled. As welcome as it was, the distraction offered by the Indians' enthusiastic games could not outpace the deepening foreboding among the men. With each passing day, it was becoming increasingly clear to Roosevelt that he was going to have to take drastic measures if the expedition hoped to descend and survive the River of Doubt. Even before reaching Tapirapoan, the men had agreed that not all of them would be able to descend the river. While they made their way across the highlands, they had been steadily adding men to their expedition, men who would be indispensable to their safety and the success of their journey. In Tapirapoan alone, they had added 148 camaradas to the contingent of 11 officers. Of greatest importance to the expedition were the additions of Dr. Cajazeira and a man named Lieutenant Jean Salustiano Lira. A military engineer and skilled surveyor, Lira had accompanied Rondon on three of his previous expeditions, including the 1909 journey during which he discovered the River of Doubt and had helped map large swaths of the Amazon. Although he had come close to losing his life several times while following Rondon, Lira had never hesitated to venture back into the jungle with his colonel. It was immediately apparent to everyone in the expedition that the cuts would have to come from within the American contingent, not the Brazilian. The first difficult decision had centered on the two American naturalists, Cherry and Miller. Although both men were hard-working and experienced explorers, their skills overlapped to a large degree, and having two naturalists was a luxury that the expedition could no longer afford. Only one of the men would continue with the expedition. The other would descend to the Ji Paraná, which Rondon had already mapped, but which would offer good opportunities for collecting. This was a less dangerous journey, though not significantly so, judging from the recent drowning deaths of Rondon's soldiers on the same river, and could be made in a batalão, a large wooden boat with a tree-trunk keel and arched palm-leaf roof, that Rondon had arranged to have sent up the river to meet them. Scientifically, however, it was also much less important than the descent of the wild, unknown River of Doubt, and neither the hard-bitten middle-aged Cherry nor the ambitious young Miller had much interest in it. Rather than choose between his two naturalists, Roosevelt had suggested that they draw lots or find some other way to make the decision themselves. After giving the matter some thought, however, Miller had simply fallen on his sword. "It seemed to me that, as Cherry was the older and more experienced man," he wrote, "he was justly entitled to accompany the colonel on the journey down the New River." Roosevelt agreed with Miller's decision, but sought to ease the young man's disappointment. "When I get back, I am anxious to help you send Miller to complete his work around Mount Duida," he wrote to Osborne. "You ought to have $5,000 for the trip. I will subscribe $1,000 and do my best to help raise the remainder. I wish to give this as a kind of consolation prize to Miller." Roosevelt had also concluded that his old friend Father Zahm was not suited to the treacherous passage down the uncharted river. Zahm, like Miller, would continue with the expedition until it reached the River of Doubt, but at that point he would be shunted off to another, less challenging journey. Father Zahm has now been definitely relegated from the Rio da Dúvida trip and goes down the Ji Paraná, Kermit wrote to his mother. Even though the trip had been Zahm's idea in the first place, and, at his age and with his failing health, he was unlikely to return to the Amazon, few members of the expedition shed any tears for him. "All for each and each for all is a good motto," Roosevelt had once written, "but only on condition that each works with might and main to so maintain himself as not to be a burden to others." Kermit certainly would not miss the elderly priest. He had thought Zahm unfit for this type of expedition from the moment he met him in Bahia, and this impression had only been confirmed as the expedition progressed. Zahm had no real harm to him, Kermit wrote. "He's just a very commonplace little fool." Even Roosevelt had placed increasingly less stock in his old friend. "Of our whole expedition, everyone works hard except good little Father Zahm," he wrote to Edith. But though he would not excuse Zahm's flaws, Roosevelt always treated the priest kindly, never forgetting that he had been one of his few faithful friends in 1912. Throughout the campaign, Zahm had carefully monitored the political pulse of the Catholic laity, and at a time when nearly everyone else was abandoning Roosevelt, he had made it clear that his own support was unwavering. Borrowing from Psalm 44, Zahm had encouraged his friend to prospere, procede, et regna. Proceed prosperously, and rain. "Win or lose, Father," Roosevelt had answered, "there are certain friendships I have tested in this campaign, and among these friendships is my friendship with you." Zahm must have been humiliated to find himself pushed out of the expedition that he had planned to lead with Roosevelt. But characteristically rebounding, he sought to make the best of it, asserting that the change in plans had actually been his own idea. Indeed, Zahm, the master of self-promotion, could do even better than that. After reaching Manaus, he assured his brother Albert, he then planned to set off on an expedition that would outshine nearly any other in its feats of exploration. If his health held up, he wrote, he hoped to travel through the heart of South America, from Patagonia to the Caribbean. It will be the first time the trip has ever been made, and will, in the estimation of everyone that has heard of it, be an extraordinary achievement, and one that will contribute more towards making the southern continent known to the world than any similar undertaking in South American history. This is the opinion of some of the most eminent men in South America, all of whom are enthusiastic about the enterprising sacerdote norteamericano, as they are pleased to call me. Any prospect that Father Zahm might have had for reviving his hopes of glory with his new itinerary, however, was soon undone by his worsening relations with the rest of the men, and his concern for his own comfort. Even now, Father Zahm came up with a new idea for the remainder of his journey with the expedition, and proposed it to Rondon. Given the discomforts of traveling, the priest explained, the best solution would be for him to ride in a divan chair on the shoulders of four strong Indians. This suggestion seemed straightforward and practical to Zahm, but Roosevelt and Rondon must have been rendered almost speechless by the image of Father Zahm riding across the highlands like Montezuma on the bent backs of his subjects. While the Brazilian colonel kept his composure, he made it perfectly clear to Zahm that no Parecy would submit to such degrading and subservient work. Surprised that Rondon had recoiled at his suggestion, Father Zahm reassured him that in Peru, carrying a member of the Roman Catholic clergy in such a fashion was an honor worth disputing. Father Zahm called our attention to the noteworthy fact that such a great difference should exist in the natures of men of an almost identical degree of civilization, Rondon later wrote, restraining his contempt for Zahm, but just barely. We, however, did not share in our friend's astonishment, inasmuch as we consider this and other differences as natural consequences of the methods adopted for the education of the Indians. If we propose to educate men so that they may incorporate themselves into our midst and become our co-citizens, we have nothing more to do than to persevere in applying the methods up to the present adopted in Brazil. If, however, our intention is to create servants of a restricted and special society, the best road to follow would be the one opened by the Jesuitic teachings. When it was clear that Rondon would not relent, Zahm appealed to Roosevelt, a decision that proved to be his undoing. Indians are meant to carry priests, he explained to his old friend, and I have resorted to such transportation several times. Roosevelt, who was well aware that Rondon was an Indian and a positivist, and had witnessed firsthand the mistreatment of Indians in the Dakota territories, chose his words carefully before replying to Father Zahm. But you will not commit such an affront to my dear Colonel Rondon's principles, he said in measured tones. Since the day he had met Rondon on the Paraguay-Brazil border, Roosevelt had gone to great lengths to show his Brazilian co-commander every courtesy and mark of respect that his experience and position, as well as his character, deserved. Not only did Roosevelt admire Rondon's accomplishments as an explorer and a military man, but he respected his philosophical beliefs. The colonel's positivism was in very fact to him a religion of humanity, Roosevelt wrote, a creed which bade him be just and kindly and useful to his fellow men, to live his life bravely, and no less bravely to face death, without reference to what he believed or did not believe, or to what the unknown hereafter might hold for him. Roosevelt also insisted that he and Rondon be treated as equals in every way, One night, during their overland journey, as the men sat on the damp ground around their oxhide dinner table, Rondon had ceremoniously produced two chairs, one for Roosevelt and the other for Father Zahm. Zahm surely welcomed the simple luxury, but Roosevelt refused to take a seat unless Rondon also had a chair. Mr. Roosevelt positively declared to me that as long as he was in the wilderness he would accept nothing and do nothing that might have an appearance of special attention to his person, Rondon recalled. And consequently, just as he saw me sit, so would he sit himself. Father Zahm, however, apparently did not have the same qualms about demanding special treatment. Finally, after what Rondon described as a heated exchange over Zahm's request to be carried in a divan chair, Roosevelt invited the priest to step into his tent. By the time the two men reappeared, Zahm was on his way home. "Since you cannot ride a horse," Roosevelt told him, "you will go back to Tapirapoan accompanied by Sig." No one was happier to hear the news of Zahm's departure than Kermit. "Father Zahm is being sent back from here," he wrote Bell. "He showed himself so completely incompetent and selfish that he got on everyone's nerves, and then he tried a couple of things that made it easy to send him back." The next day, Roosevelt sat down with a blank piece of paper and, aware that his friend would arrive home ahead of him, took the unusual step of handwriting a brief but formal record of Zahm's dismissal, which everyone but the Kamaradish signed.
"Utiariti, February 1st, 1914. Every member of the expedition has told me that in his opinion, it is essential to the success and well-being of the expedition that Father Zahm should at once leave it and return to the settled country. Theodore Roosevelt." The above statement is correct. Candido Mariano Rondon, Leo E. Miller, J. S. Lira, George K. Cherry, José A. Cajazera, Jacob Sig, Eusebio Paul, L. Oliveira, Anthony Fiala, Kermit Roosevelt. Even Sig, whom Zahm had hired and whose fate was tied to the priests, stepped forward to sign the document.
After leaving Utiariti, the mule train resumed its grueling progress toward the headwaters of the River of Doubt, adhering closely to the crude trail blazed by the Rondon Commission. An astronomical effort had gone into simply erecting the poles that supported the telegraph line. First, a team of about 20 men would map the area, cutting down and stripping the branches from trees deemed straight and tall enough to hold up their raw copper wires. Then an ox cart would deliver a newly dismembered tree to the 8 men whose job it was to erect the telegraph pole. 2 men would slip a rope around the pole, and then strain to pull it toward them from one side, while the other 6 men struggled to lift the pole from the opposite direction. It was dirty, exhausting work that was usually done in blazing heat or a thunderous downpour, and on an empty stomach. Following in the path of the telegraph builders, Roosevelt and his men were spared the exhausting and often deadly toil that had gone into building the lines. But even so, their progress was still painfully slow, and their daily routine was defined by the same strict military regimentation and discipline that were the hallmark of all Rondon's explorations. Every morning the men were startled out of their sleep by a sharp bugle. As they awoke, Juan, a black camarada, whom Miller described as being as big-hearted and obliging as he was tall and powerful, would duck his head into their tent with a pot full of coffee, which he poured black and steaming into aluminum cups. In the tender light of the early morning, the camaradas would saddle their mules so that they would be ready to ride as soon as the officers finished their breakfast. Roosevelt would usually try to duck away at this time, to get in some writing before the long day's ride began. This was often his only opportunity to work on the series of articles he was writing for Scribner's magazine. Once the men mounted their mules, they did not stop until late in the afternoon, and then usually had to wait 4 or 5 hours more for the mule train to arrive with their baggage. Before they left camp each morning, Rondon would announce how many kilometers they would ride that day. There were 11 telegraph line poles per kilometer, and a consecutive number had been carved into each pole, so, by watching the poles pass by, The men could easily estimate how far they had to go until they reached the next campsite. Even a short day, however, could seem unbearably long. Kermit had developed sores on his legs, and they became so inflamed that at one point he had to spend almost an entire day standing straight up in his stirrups. Early in the overland journey, Cherry had driven a palm thorn into one of his legs, and the point remained buried a half inch deep in the muscle, partially paralyzing his foot. They were all tormented by hordes of gnats, sandflies, horseflies, and small stingless bees that the Brazilians call lambe oio, or eye lickers. These bees swarmed around their hands and faces, congregating at the corners of their eyes and buzzing about their lips with maddening persistence. Not even the most thundering swat would dissuade them. As described by H.M. Tomlinson, who had traveled through the Amazon in 1909 and 1910 and had suffered their ceaseless attention, the stingless bees preferred death to being dislodged from their enjoyment. The most difficult part of every day's ride, however, was the rain, which had begun mildly enough at the beginning of their journey, but was now falling, Kermit wrote his mother, mournfully, dismally, and ceaselessly, in a sort of hopeless, insistent way. Their mules slipped and stumbled in the slick, thickening mud, and collecting specimens for the museum had become, Cherry complained, a practical impossibility. One day the Americans and the Brazilian officers were obliged to stand without shelter of any kind for hours in a heavy downpour while they waited for the mule train to arrive with their tents. "Everything became moldy," Roosevelt wrote, "except what became rusty." The weather only deepened Roosevelt's concern about Kermit, whose malaria had continued to worsen, leaving him with a debilitating fever that now reached as high as 102 degrees. For Roosevelt, worry about his second son had become as familiar as the swelling pride he felt when he reflected on all that the young man had already accomplished. As proud as Roosevelt was of his son's physical stamina and vigorous work ethic, he feared that Kermit might one day push himself too far. In Africa, Roosevelt had watched with growing alarm as Kermit threw himself into increasingly dangerous situations. "It is hard to realize that the rather timid boy of 4 years ago has turned out a perfectly cool and daring fellow," Roosevelt had written his oldest son, Ted Jr. "Indeed, he is a little too reckless and keeps my heart in my throat, for I worry about him all the time. He is not a good shot, not even as good as I am, and heaven knows I am poor enough. But he is a bold rider, always cool and fearless, and eager to work all day long. He ran down and killed a giraffe alone, and a hyena also. And the day before yesterday he stopped a charging leopard within 6 yards of him, after it had mauled one of our porters." Now, in a remote corner of the Brazilian interior, Roosevelt worried less about Kermit's aim than about his ability to fight off the deadly diseases of the Amazon or survive the River of Doubt. He could not bear the thought of facing Belle and Edith if anything happened to Kermit. Kermit had joined the expedition so that he could protect his father. But it was Roosevelt who now feared for his son. On February 4th, Roosevelt, perhaps shaken by the provisions the expedition had already lost, the lonely telegraph workers' graves he had seen, Margaret's death, and his son's illness, decided that it was imperative to the success of the expedition that he cut another man from his team. Unfortunately, that man was the member of the expedition who, with the possible exception of Father Zahm, had hung the greatest hopes on this journey to the Amazon. After they made camp near Buriti, a swift, deep river that afforded them the luxury of a much-needed bath, Roosevelt called Anthony Fiala aside. With deep regret, he gave him the painful news that he would not be descending the River of Doubt with the rest of the expedition. Although Fiala had done his best to please Roosevelt, his knowledge of Arctic exploration and the hard lessons he had learned there had failed to translate to the Amazon. Miller dismissed Fiala out of hand, writing to Chapman that their quartermaster was quite incompetent to do a single thing, and Cherry readily agreed. "I have not written anything about the organization of our expedition, but now I'm going to record my opinion that a greater lack of organization seems hardly possible," he had written in his diary on November 25th, while he and Miller were still in Corumbá. There is no head, no chief of the expedition. Fiala, in a way, is the temporary head, but utterly incompetent for the work he has to do. Without previous experience in the tropics, without any knowledge of the character of the people with whom he must treat, and the almost insurmountable handicap of not having any knowledge of the language. Of the trio of adventurous Americans whom Roosevelt had nicknamed the Three Buccaneers, Cherry, Miller, and Fiala, only Cherry would actually go on the expedition that they had all planned to take together. But, as he had for Miller, Roosevelt made an effort to find another river journey for Fiala so that he would have some compensation for the months he had already devoted to the expedition. His plan was for the photographer to descend the Papagayo River, much of which had yet to be explored, even though its source and mouth were relatively well known. Fiala accepted the offer, but his heart clearly wasn't in it. Although the men had had little sympathy for Father Zahm, they could not help pitying Fiala, whose cherished opportunity to redeem himself as an explorer was now lost. Fiala left us and started back toward Utiariti at 10 p.m., Cherry wrote in his diary that night. I think his going had a saddening effect on all of us. And Fiala himself was almost in tears. Chapter 9. Warnings from the Dead. The oxen have given out, Kermit recorded in the cream-colored pages of his bound Letts of London journal on February the 6th, 1914. As drastic as Roosevelt's cutbacks in men and equipment had been, it had quickly become apparent that they were not enough. The expedition was faltering again. Not only were the oxen collapsing, the mules were dying at an alarming rate. Since Tapirapoan, the expedition had lost more than half of its 98 mules, and of those that remained, 10 could barely walk. If the men hoped to reach the banks of the River of Doubt, their only option was to make more sacrifices, gambling that the provisions and equipment that they abandoned now would not be desperately needed later on. Before the overland journey had even begun, Roosevelt had insisted that they leave behind half of the tents that the Brazilian government had given them as gifts in Tapirapoan, and which, he later confided to the Royal Geographic Society's John Scott Kelty, were enormously heavy and utterly unsuited for the work. He now urged Rondon to get rid of half of the tents that remained. I had to exercise real tact, he wrote Kelty, because it almost broke the heart of good Colonel Rondon. Our companions cared immensely for what they regarded as splendor. Two ox carts, groaning with the weight of their cargo, were abandoned, as were two trunks of specimens that Miller and Cherry had collected and preserved for the museum. The naturalists were even forced to part with most of their collecting equipment. Each man then cut his personal baggage in half, keeping, Roosevelt wrote, only the sheer necessities. Kermit faithfully did his part to throw out what he did not absolutely need. He counted as necessities, however, his packet of letters from Belle, including a small picture of her that he always carried in his shirt pocket, and which he feared she would not recognize. What with it being wet through so many times? And his books, which were heavy but essential. Through all the lightening of baggage I have kept my books, he wrote Belle. It means a lot to go to a quiet place to read the poems that we both like, and those that I always associate with you. The poems were from the Oxford Book of French Verse. Besides this volume and the Oxford Book of English Verse, the rest of Kermit's books were written in Portuguese, with the notable exception of his copies of the Iliad and the Odyssey, which were in the original Greek. As crucial as it was for the expedition to lighten the pack animals' loads, however, much of what they were carrying was not expendable. Before they began jettisoning crates of food and other critical supplies, Roosevelt, using all of his diplomatic skills so as not to offend his co-commander, questioned Rondon about the expedition's preparedness for the River of Doubt. If there was any possibility that they might not have all that they needed to make a safe descent, he told Rondon, they should walk, reserving every able-bodied animal for carrying provisions rather than passengers. Rondon would not have minded the walk at all from the physical standpoint, Roosevelt wrote, but he simply could not bear to have us take action which he regarded as an admission that we were not doing the thing in splendid style. He assured Roosevelt that there was no need to take such a drastic step. Everyone in the expedition would be well provided for on the River of Doubt. On February 8th, the American and Brazilian officers finally reached the Juruena River, the site of another of Rondon's remote and isolated telegraph stations. Pausing on a hilltop, the men looked back over the miles of rolling landscape that they had crossed, shrouded in low, thick forest. Farther north, the 600-mile-long Juruena widened significantly, but even here, in its relatively narrow southern reaches, it was broad and deep enough to force the mules to cross it on a rickety raft composed of a wooden platform lashed onto three dugout canoes. When they reached the other side, pulling themselves across the rushing current with a wire trolley, the men were, as always, relieved to stop at a telegraph station. Their accommodations would again be a simple wattle and daub hut with a thatched roof and plenty of cracks and chinks for the sandflies to find their way inside and torment them throughout the night. But it was better than spending another miserable night in rain-soaked tents. As it had in Utiarity, however, bad news awaited the expedition in Juruena. This time, it was about Fiala. From a telegram that was handed to Roosevelt, the men learned that the first day of their friend's descent of the Papagaio River had nearly been his last. Fiala's expedition, which had begun just the day before without any of the provisions he had packed for Roosevelt's journey, had met with immediate and almost complete disaster. Not long after they had launched their three dugout canoes, two of them, including the one in which Fiala was riding, were sucked into a churning pocket of the river known as the Rapids of the Devil. Most of the nine men had managed to fight their way back to the bank, but Fiala, along with half of the expedition's food and most of its equipment, was swept helplessly down the river. "I just saved myself by snatching hold of a tree bough that overhung the stream about 30 feet from the bank, and then pulling myself in," Fiala told a reporter for the New York Times after returning home. The Brazilians, whom Rondon had assigned to accompany Fiala, however, told their colonel a very different story. It was true that the boats had capsized, they said. But Fiala did not save himself. In fact, he very nearly caused the drowning death of the man who ultimately rescued him from the rapids. Even if Fiala had once again led his men into a disaster, with new doubts about his actions, the ill-starred explorer had at least been proved right on one count. His insistence that North American canoes were the proper means for descending the Amazon's dangerous tributaries. Fiala blamed his near death in the Papagaio Rapids on the heavy, clumsy South American dugouts. After his first disastrous day on the Papagaio, Fiala refused to trust the dugouts a second time. He returned to Utiarity and retrieved the Canadian canoes that he himself had hand-picked, and which Roosevelt's expedition had left behind because they could not afford the additional weight. The Brazilians on his team thought that their commander had lost his mind and balked at the idea of boarding such an insubstantial-looking canoe, especially since Rondon held them responsible for Fiala's safety. However, when they saw how buoyantly the canoe rode the rapids, Fiala later proudly recalled, how a twist of the paddle would deflect it around a rock on which a dugout would crash and smash, they gave cries of delight. Fiala's selection of his Canadian canoes had been vindicated. Miles away, on his journey to the River of Doubt, however, Roosevelt had no way to know that, and could do nothing about it even if he had. Outside of Juruena, moreover, the men's concern about accidental mishaps, dying mules, and low supplies were compounded by a new fear: calculated attack. The hum of the telegraph wires, as familiar now as the weary clop, clop, clop of their mules' hooves on the wet clay and sand soil, was the only sign of civilization in the broad scrub forest before them. They felt as isolated as if they were traveling across an uninhabited planet. They were not alone, however, and they knew that there was rarely a moment of the day or night when they were not being watched. They were now, Roosevelt wrote, in a still wilder region, the land of the naked Nambikaras. Rondon had made first contact with this tribe, one of the most isolated and primitive of the Amazon, only 6 years earlier. They had welcomed him with a fusillade of poison-tipped arrows. Hoping to make a clear gesture of friendship, Rondon and just three of his men, including Lyra, had ridden single file toward a Nambikara camp, their mules heaped high with gifts. But before they had even reached the camp, Rondon had felt something fly past his face that was so light and fast that for a moment he thought it was a bird. In the millisecond it took him to realize that it was an arrow, a second one slammed into his helmet. The third arrow struck his chest and lodged in his thick leather bandolier, ordering his men not to return fire. Rondon calmly turned his mule around and rode back to his own camp, sitting straight in his saddle with the arrow, 5 feet long, with a 10-inch macaw feather split in two on one end and a serrated curare-coated tip on the other, still sticking out of his chest. For weeks, the Nambikara had terrorized Rondon's men, disappearing during the day and attacking at night when the soldiers were most vulnerable. The men were so frightened that they refused even to build a campfire after the sun went down, in the hope that the Nambikara would not be able to find them on the Black Plateau. Gradually, however, Rondon had won the Indians over, by first wooing them with gifts and then luring them to his campsite by playing a phonograph at night, sending the strains of a Wagnerian opera into the forest like a beautiful incorporeal siren. Through persistent kindness, compassion, and patience in the face of relentless and often deadly attacks, he had forged a simple peace. But it was tentative at best, and had met with varying degrees of success within the tribe's scattered and independent bands. For the telegraph station workers, the men whom Rondon left behind to guard and repair the poles after the rest of the expedition had moved on, the Nambikara remained a constant threat. In general, long-term peace between the telegraph station workers and the Indians was rare. Although the relationship usually started out on a friendly footing, Rondon having ordered the workers to be kind to the Indians, not meddle in their affairs, and give them plenty of gifts, it almost always devolved into resentment and distrust. The telegraph station workers, moreover, were utterly alone, with no hope of help from any quarter, and with a store of coveted weapons and metal tools that made them enticing targets. In the late 1930s, the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss traveled along Rondon's telegraph line and heard many stories of telegraph workers who had died grisly deaths at the hands of the Nambikara. "Someone may recall," Lévi-Strauss wrote in his seminal book, Triste Tropique, "how a certain telegraph operator was found buried up to the waist, with his chest riddled with arrows and his Morse key on his head." Even missionaries, who were ostensibly there to help the Indians, body and soul, had difficulty staying alive in Nambikara territory. The seemingly simplest of misunderstandings could lead to the slaughter of an entire missionary community. Lévi-Strauss told the story of one such massacre that happened in the very region through which Roosevelt and his men were now traveling. A Protestant mission came to settle not far from the post at Juruena. It would seem that relations soon became embittered, the natives having been dissatisfied with the gifts, inadequate, apparently, that the missionaries had given them in return for their help in building the house and planting the garden. A few months later, an Indian with a high temperature presented himself at the mission and was publicly given 2 aspirin tablets, which he swallowed. Afterwards, he bathed in the river, developed congestion of the lungs, and died. As the Nambikara are expert poisoners, they concluded that their fellow tribesmen had been murdered. They launched a retaliatory attack during which 6 members of the mission were massacred, including a 2-year-old child. Only 1 woman was found alive by a search party sent out from Cuiabá. Even where relationships appeared to be well established, there was still a good chance that things could go disastrously wrong. Rondon did his best to civilize the Indians who lived near his telegraph stations, a perhaps misguided effort for which he would be criticized in later years. But he did not control them, and he never would. In Utiariti, he taught the Paresi Indians, one of the region's most sophisticated and peaceful tribes, how to build more substantial houses. He helped them grow potatoes, corn, and manioc, and he gave them clothing. He even hired some of them to work for the Rondon Commission, paying the average worker 66 cents a day, particularly valuable employees a dollar, and cheap.